Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Welcome back to another Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski. I got my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski, Jr., super endocrinologist. And we got a guest, also a very good friend of mine, Dr. Kevin Klatt. He's an RD and PhD. And between sending memes back and forth with me, he does a lot of research on all sorts of stuff. So we're going to pick his brain about... We're gonna pick his brain. I kind of want to hear though. I don't actually think I know your.
Let's just stick with his brain.
I don't know. We could go a little bit further than his brain, I suppose. I kind of want to know a little bit about your background. So Kevin's the guy that I go to when there's like a new study about nutrition out, and you know, like I'm pretty good at looking at the basics of these studies, but you know, he's a PhD RD, kind of the top echelon of understanding nutritional science stuff. So when a new study comes out, I'm like, hey, what's the deal with this? And he gives me a very long breakdown and we go over it. It's very nice to have that resource. So what's your background? Where'd you go to undergrad?
I did my undergrad at Temple University. I originally went there actually to do like international business, and I took Chinese in high school, and but quickly wanted to change to science. So my undergrad didn't have a nutrition major, even though that's what I knew I wanted to do. So I did biological anthropology, mainly because it was the most flexible undergrad science major, where you could shove in, you know, all of the prerequisite courses you'd need to be a dietitian and also kind of go on for a PhD. I knew pretty early on that like I wanted to do a clinician scientist track, and I would have a heart attack if I signed $300,000 in loans. So medical school was like immediately off the table for me, just from the loan perspective. So I was pretty dead set on PhD RD from the get-go there. So bioanthro ended up being kind of a nice lead-in, because like the paleo diet got really hot. And so I had like kind of tailored.
You took the words out of my mouth. I was going to just ask if you're a paleo shill because of that.
No. I don't think many people in evolutionary anthropology are the biggest fans of the paleo diet per se, but it was fun because we did like anthropology of food and kind of studying different hunter-gatherer populations across the globe, and what we like the methods for how we can know what our past hominid ancestors ate at different times throughout hominid evolution, and you know, what primates eat, and doing primate ethnography. So it was, alongside being able to do the physiology, the biochemistry, all that kind of stuff, it was nice. When the paleo diet got big, I was just like, I don't think this is all that legit. And after that, I went to Drexel for a year, which is right near Temple in Philadelphia, and did some research and some of the DPD courses to become a dietitian. But I just did 1 year of that and then applied out to go to Cornell for my PhD in molecular nutrition. And then I did my dietetic internship after my PhD, which was a little bit weird for most people's trajectories, but I did it at the National Institutes of Health.
That is weird. Oh. NIH.
when were you there? And you're talking Bethesda?
Yeah, I was in Bethesda. It was like, I finished my PhD in 2018. So it would have been 2018, 2019 year that I did the dietetic internship. Oh. Yeah.
When was I? I was at
Walter Reed, right?
Walter Reed Bethesda, right across the street, for my endocrine fellowship. But that was, you know, I was a fellow from 2013 to 2015, so I actually rotated over at NIH. Spencer has some funny anecdotes for that, but it's nobody would understand it. But and then I was still faculty for a couple of years, so I was around there, but apparently before your time.
He did a rotation there and he made a post about like, hey, I'm rotating at the NIH right now. And he got in big trouble because they were like, you're trying to
get in trouble. Somebody from the NIH was like, oh, he's misrepresenting, saying he's something. And then now whenever we do anything, Spencer's always like, I'm just going to cite that my brother is the head of NIH.
Yeah. Like my brother, endocrinologist, head of NIH. He's got all the authority.
But it was a great rotation, by the way, for if they're listening. It was really.
Yeah, it was relatively quiet that year.
That's yeah. So you have an interesting background. So and now what kind of research are you doing right now?
So I actually have a lot of spillover from my PhD, and my PhD kind of naturally led into a postdoc, and I continue to follow up on it. So in my PhD work, I actually was both fortunate and also, I guess, a little masochistic in that I did co-chairs for my dissertation committee and worked in two labs, one in a basic science reproductive endocrinology lab, and then one in more of a controlled feeding human intervention liquid chromatography mass spec focused lab there was a lot of pregnancy work going on there. So it was a natural kind of link between like repro endo on the basic science side and then more pregnancy nutrition on the human side of things. And so I had a human controlled trial of choline supplementation throughout the second and third trimester of pregnancy that was going on while I was there, but it didn't finish until actually after I left. And then I also did a bunch of work in a basic sense, looking at cellular metabolism of lauric acid, which is C12. It's one of the saturates that raises LDL. But we had some reason to believe, and we're still kind of doing a bunch of work on it being a pretty potent signaling molecule through the genome through a class of receptors called nuclear receptors. So it's a big nutrigenomics process progress that actually spilled into a postdoc. Which I did down at Baylor College of Medicine for a couple of years. That was mainly during the pandemic. And then my boss there moved out to Berkeley. So I'm here now. And there's a preprint of that paper. It's all about how lauric acid gets incorporated into a phosphatidylcholine species that looks like a pretty strong ligand for this orphan nuclear receptor. Nobody really talks about that much. I keep doing that kind of basic work and just diet and nuclear receptor and more broadly metabolism and nuclear receptors work as well. And then I have, I'm on a clinical trial in Tanzania, actually, looking at vitamin B12 metabolism. So part of my clinical trial, my PhD was, you know, lots of pregnancy work, but also how do we use stable isotopes to better understand metabolism. And if you're trying to study how is pregnancy different than the non-pregnant state, stable isotopes are quite important. And so that trial is looking at vitamin B12 pharmacokinetics across pregnancy in the context of a controlled feeding study. So I do some controlled feeding work with that as well.
So if anybody wanted to know, Kevin's pretty smart. My brother and I don't know what the hell he's talking about.
I was going to say the same thing.
No, but we have a good idea, but it clearly goes way more into bench research than we're have any training in. It's pretty cool to hear. So I kind of wanted to give the listeners a little taste of, like, you know, when I come to you and we talk about a study, like how you can go basically Rain Man, like you just did, and kind of go into depth, you know, kind of thing, like into
just depth. Don't read our DMs
on some of these things. stay out of the DMs because it gets a little risque and maybe slightly vulgar. I don't know.
I stay out of them because if anybody found that, I'd be fired.
Again, always.
Again, I know. I keep
every
fired.
Episode. I think
every episode, I get fired. You get
up. Okay, so diet research in general, like when you see a headline, a new study shows that eggs are now good for you. They were bad, but now researchers are saying they're good for you. I know that I'm not going to pull out a specific one, but there are one of these comes out every single year. And for someone that's listening, that they don't, you know, they don't have an RD PhD, they're not going to be able to, you know, really quickly assess, go into the methods and everything like that. What's the guidance around this? What should we even pay attention to some of these headlines and just forget it, or should we? You know, if you're trying to make sure you're up to date on eating the best types of foods, what should you do? I don't know. I don't even know how to give this guidance because I'm always like, just send it to me. I'll kind of look at it and see.
Yeah, it's difficult when the media sensationalizes studies without having some sort of expert opinion based deciphering of it.
Yeah. Like someone like you to kind of describe this, like what should somebody do if they're out there listening?
I usually tell people just ignore headlines. If you're trying to be, if evidence-based eating for you is guided by headlines, you're going to change your diet like pretty much every week. Depending on what your specific, algorithm is feeding to you per se. I think it's gotten worse in recent years. Like there's even, I think, some data on university press offices really hyping things up, which then goes out through some PR newswire to all these different news sources. And seeing how the media works, it just looks like nutrition is a source of clicks that make the money. And it doesn't mean that I don't want to discount. I still talk with journalists sometimes when they reach out to me. And if you're following it as just science, it's not a bad place to get some of the literature that's being published and some things you might want to talk about and be aware of for patients. But for the average patient, if you're trying to use media headlines and the contextualization in a news report to guide your diet, it's probably fraught. And there's lots of reasons for this, but most of it is just it's a single new analysis that isn't contextualized within the body of the literature, with funding being kind of strapped and tight. More researchers, I think, feel inclined to emphasize the broader impacts and translational capacity of their work. So even if it's a highly limited study that is one small piece of the larger body of evidence that we would look at on guideline committees and things like that, researchers are not always contextualizing it that way and sort of blow it up like our study is life-changing. and there's various incentives within academia, I think, that are need to be relooked at. But sadly, for the everyday person, I just kind of am there's no way you're gonna, I have been in this my whole career basically, and trying to learn every method in nutrition that we possibly have to better understand it. And I don't even keep up with all of the media headlines. And I think it's impossible for any one person to do. And so with that, I don't know how a consumer would look at this and try and eat evidence-based. And if you start to look at the history of nutrition, you'll just see that these things cycle over the past 50 plus years of really intense print and then social media news attention. It's you can find almost the same headline from 10 years ago that has doubled back on itself 55 times. And I kind of call it, there's lots of talk about medical reversal. I call it pseudo medical reversal, where there's an incentive for the media to make it seem nutrition's always wrong. And then, and often the question is so poorly worded and so unscientific, or against the first principles of nutrition science, are eggs good or bad, is an inherently untestable hypothesis. And it's an unanswerable question based off what we know in nutrition and how nutrition study designs work. But when you pose it that way, you can play ping pong in the media for years and get all the clicks in the world and confuse the public. And it snowballs pretty quick.
So you brought up a point that I wanted to have your take on it. And I try to explain this to patients and people online and whatever, is that nutrition science is one of the harder sciences to actually do the research on, right? And get good, very good answers that can ultimately turn into, real life guidance, just because of the nature of it, because we all have to eat no matter what.
Yeah, well, right? Think about the difference between, I mean, Kevin, you love talking about this on social media. You think about a placebo drug trial, you give a placebo, you give a drug, and then you watch what happens. In nutrition, it's not so simple, right? It's hard to give a placebo type of food.
There's a lot about nutrition that I think, nutrition could be, I like to contextualize this within the context of thinking okay, if you want to talk to somebody about what is a diet that you could change for, some short-term quality of life outcome or whatever, we could know it really robustly. But I think most people immediately link nutrition to chronic disease, and that's where the media kind of clickbaits all of this. I actually work in pregnancy nutrition a good bit, because pregnancy, give or take, is around 9 months. It's a studyable period of time. You can use tools to actually get close to the definitive answers to things, depending on how you pose your hypothesis. And I realized pretty early on in my research career that studying, you know, how saturated fats impact on LDL is going to be linked to chronic disease. It's going to have so many elements to it that are like, there's always a level of uncertainty. And that's not to say that people should go out and eat. Like, I still recommend patients with high LDL to reduce saturated fat intakes and whatnot. But there's a level of uncertainty that as a scientist is often can be weird to sit with. And I often find my like RD and scientist brain are like a little bit at like, okay, what are the compromises that we are coming into here? What biases come into play? But yeah, I would say I stick to research questions or I feel like I can definitively answer them because it's fulfilling and not like have 8 million limitations at the end of my discussion section that then I still go and make like strong conclusions from. It's a little uncomfy for me at times. But for the like listener, I think, yeah, this the drug example of like there's not a placebo. So like randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trials are often taught as like the top of the pyramid and the hierarchy of like at least individual studies and then well-done systematic reviews and meta-analyses of those being kind of the top level of evidence. And it's not that that's not potentially true in nutrition as well, but you can imagine just off of randomization we can do in diet to some degree, but without the ability to blind. And, you know, what's the placebo for red meat, if you want to say that? What's the placebo for eggs? What's the placebo for walnut foods?
Right.
It doesn't exist. And you see this kind of early on come out in the literature where it's, you know, when you look at the dietary fat and blood cholesterol studies where it's like, okay, if I compare saturated fat, like its impact on blood cholesterol by just feeding people, you know, 2 tablespoons of butter extra a day, well, the impact on cholesterol that you're seeing could be because you're feeding more calories. And then it's like, okay, well, let's go to the next study design where you do 2 tablespoons of butter versus 2 tablespoons of olive oil. And so in that study design, though, it's you're not sure if the effect of butter is just the is butter making LDL go up or a monounsaturated fatty acids and olive oil making LDL go down. And so you quickly get into these like multi-arm, multi-pairwise comparison studies of all the different fat types relative to each other. Because you don't really have a placebo. And that's just with thinking along the lines of macronutrients that have calories. But then when you come into food, like our egg example, it's a personal pet peeve of mine that a lot of commodity boards, which I'm a big fan of, like I think industry can work with scientists and I've had industry money in the past and they've paid for us to do research that definitely doesn't really support their bottom line all that much because you can find good industry partners. But yeah, a lot of commodity group trials end up being like, you know, the title will be avocados do this and walnuts are amazing for the microbiome and all this stuff. And, you know, the nutrition scientist immediately looks at those headlines and goes, okay, what did they feed the control group? Because it wasn't just like 200 calories extra of eggs or avocado or walnut. And scarily, it's sometimes hard to figure out what they fed the control group. You might get the nutrient profile, but not the food. And they often keep it isocaloric. So it'll be 200 calories of avocado versus 200 calories of whatever else. And what you find is that it's like muffins or other refined grain, often high saturated fat, high sugar foods are used as the control group when you look into these studies and other similar things that you'd be like, okay, yeah, like an avocado versus a Pop-Tart, it like affects the microbiome. Like this is not what causal inferences are you expecting to make there? And you know, it gets into the headlines and even often the study title as like avocados do blah, 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 blah. And you have to dig, you have to get through a paywall to get to the methods to figure out what the comparator food is. And so when I talk with, I still see patients on the side and I always tell them, if you see a headline that only calls out a single food, and nothing, a new study shows blah, 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 and doesn't say the comparator food, immediately ignore it. It has violated our first principle of nutrition science that we don't have, apart from micronutrient supplementation studies where you can give like a little capsule full of inert cornstarch relative to, if you even need to do that, relative to like, you know, vitamin B12 supplement or whatever, then you don't have a placebo and you need to contextualize that, what that comparator is. And we see this all the time too in pretty complex intervention studies where, you know, people are assigned to some probiotic intervention, but then they're also told all this background advice to remove probiotics from their diet with that they're eating at baseline and decrease intake of other probiotic foods. And nutrition interventions are often more complex than just the like cutesy little title. I think we see this with low carbohydrate diet studies a lot, where people are like, it's the carbs. Yeah. And it's like, no, in free living studies where you can't blind people to their assignment to eat a low carb diet, they're often eating high protein, they're eating low carbohydrate, they've changed their fatty acid composition in relative amounts and also absolute amounts. And there's this like big black box of confounding that it's really hard, even though it's a randomized controlled trial, if you're not able to blind people to things, you can't causally ascribe it to the name of the dietary pattern, which I think, there are so many things downstream of telling somebody to change their diet that they might change. That we often can't even measure that could be the causal factor there that make it extremely hard to interpret. Also, on the no placebo issue, I'd also just highlight like really quickly that placebo, in a statin study design, we have statins versus placebo. You don't have like background exposure to statins. And so you have a placebo in the sense of like an inert comparator. But it's also just assumed like the placebo is like you're the unexposed group. You have a true unexposed group to statins typically in these study designs. If you do like an olive oil study, it's very likely that you have olive oil in your background, or you have other oils that are also predominantly monounsaturates, and you have other polyphenol sources and things. And so, I could design you a study to make olive oil look bad for cholesterol just by comparing it to corn oil. Or comparing it to a background study that has already super high PUFA intake and MUFA intake, that's not really going to do a whole lot to budge cholesterol levels. And so background exposure to the intervention agent occurs commonly in both control and the intervention arms, and that's challenging to account for in study designs. And it really, depending on the dose response relationship of that intervention agent with the outcomes that you're measuring, it may or may not, the background exposure may or may not be a huge factor that modifies the effects of the intervention.
Yeah, I was gonna bring up the confounding thing, because like a lot of the study headlines are observational in nature, and they're trying to,
so many confounders in those studies.
Can you explain what a confounder is, Kevin?
For the lay public.
Yeah, for the lay public. What's a confounder?
Yeah, I mean, a confounder at its like most simplest is just a additional variable that is both related to the whatever we think the cause is. So like if you say, let me think of an example here, whole grains are related to cardiovascular disease intake, and we think that that relationship is causal, it could potentially be confounded if people who eat more whole grains are also doing something else, maybe just in general have healthier lifestyles, are more likely to run because they are paying attention to the news, and the news tells you to eat more whole grains, and it also tells you to work out. And so if whole grains really truly weren't causal for reducing cardiovascular disease risk, there might be a confounder like exercising more or not smoking or whatever that is actually the true causal effect there. But because those two exposure variables are related, if you don't adjust adequately for differences in folks who eat whole grains that also don't smoke and exercise more, you could have confounding that is present. And this can happen in both controlled trials, but it's much more common in epidemiology. And I realize my last spiel was all about the difficulty in doing trials. I do often find there's an overly hard take on epidemiology and nutrition, which is somewhat deserved. But then people often give trials a free pass, and I think trials are just as problematic in nutrition, if not more in some ways. But yeah, so you can have confounders in your study design that are often just either unaccounted for, unmeasured variables that are truly driving the effect that you're ascribing to one exposure that you have measured, and that exposure really isn't causal.
And what about the different types of biases that are in some of these nutritional studies? We deal with these all sorts of biases, especially in observational data, trying to correlate a couple different things. Do you think some of those, and there's all sorts of different ones, right? Different types. Do those play a significant role? And if so, probably need to describe what bias is in these studies too.
Oh my gosh, yes. There are, I think there's like a catalog of bias that you can search online. We typically try and account for biases. There's like risk of bias assessment that often occurs within systems, like when you're looking at individual studies and systematic reviews and meta-analyses. And I mean, a bias is just anything that's going to like lead to a deviation from the truth for like a result. And then there's, I mean, like a huge, huge list of different types of biases. But it can be, you can get biases from the inability to blind coming in. You can get biases because you don't have complete outcome data for a study. You can have, of other types of biases. If it's not randomized appropriately, you can get biases coming in there. If often there's like an attrition bias that happens, which is common in nutrition trials because there's like huge dropout rates. We've seen some trials that like make headlines that have sort of questioned whether saturated fats and polyunsaturated fats or recommendations around them are useful, and digging up old literature, and then you realize that it's like 50 to 70% of the people were dropping out. Because it's hard to keep people in long-term trials, and so in diet studies particularly. So yeah, this is a part of, I guess, again, back to like media, there's not really often in the short little article, you can't go through the level of like thorough in-depth calling out all the sources of biases within a study that you would want to consider. And you often want to look across studies and say, okay, this study had these specific biases and saw this effect. This study looked at a similar outcome, didn't have those biases, but had these new unique biases. And across the literature, if you keep seeing consistent effects despite their own individual biases, you know, you build up this body of evidence that you can start to see a clear effect regardless of the individual biases in the study, and we can become more confident in them. And that's why we really rely on evidence synthesis behind different guidelines and not individual studies.
So it turns out nutrition science is tough.
Yeah. And I was just going to say, anybody listening to this is going to be like, well, I guess I'm not going to do anything with my nutrition. So we got to come up with something to say, yeah, because it is. It's frustrating to people. It's frustrating to the healthcare professionals. And obviously, it's all frustrating, I'm sure, to the actual researchers. So what do we do about it?
Yeah, what do you do about it?
Well, I mean, I think this is where, like, you know, it's a shame that in, like, primary schooling and things in America, we don't get classes on causality or classes on evidence or anything, because you're often finding, like, 19 or 20-year-olds who it's their first time in college. They might hear about it if they even hear about it there. But talking to patients about, like, okay, how do we know what we know? And nutrition can be really tough. And I often just kind of focus on, like, you know, quickly, I think most people intuitively understand, like, a single study doesn't really tell you everything. We rely on paying experts who have expertise in every level of nutrition science to come together and synthesize the data after, you know, rigorous debate. And then we get guideline committees out of this pretty much. So medical guideline committees, US dietary guidelines. Not that people are going to go read that like 250-page dietary guideline document per se, but I think impressing upon folks that like you can follow the studies if it's fun and you're not like, and you're just interested in nutrition science, what the field is talking about, but aren't taking it all that seriously for changing your own diet until we have like enough evidence to really warrant changing a recommendation per se, which is totally unfulfilling to the like kind of biohacking crowd and all out there. And I don't expect that. But for the everyday patient, I mean, understanding that the ping-ponging is not real. It's just generated mainly to generate clicks in and make money for the news outlets, I think can be quite helpful for them. And then, you know, doctors, I think, are the and nurses and other primary care providers and I guess to some degree dietitians, although there aren't that many of us and we don't interface with all the patients, you know, we should be aware of new updated guidelines, new systematic reviews that might be impactful and expert breakdowns of them for how we update kind of whether, you know, we're as concerned about something or not. But I just don't know, like, I know I've talked to patients who are like, well, that's, I want to like, you know, study, I want to follow every single headline and figure out exactly what the current best knowledge is. And that often it's just impossible if you're not going to go like do a PhD in this kind of stuff. And even then you do a PhD and you get like become an expert in like a micro area, not like, you know, an expert in every single thing and every single topic in nutrition. Like I intentionally haven't spoken a bunch about nutritional epidemiology here. And we could talk about, you know, self-reported dietary intake data and biomarkers of nutrient intake and status and whatnot that are used in big cohorts where we're not randomizing people, but we're just assessing their diet at different time points and following up. But, you know, there are people whose whole career is in nutritional epidemiology, and I collaborate with them a little bit, but I'm much more of a trialist. And even I am like take nutrition epi headlines and even my own take on the literature with a grain of salt, because I know that there are expert level nuances that I'm not going to always tease out from the study designs.
Speaking of a grain of salt.
What?
Well, I was just going to say we could talk about all the salt debates, but that actually does remind me the other thing we have to deal with are not just in the research, but the people then taking the research and making recommendations who have their own more like explicit bias, because we have all these dietary evangelicals and zealots that for whatever reason either have some sort of stake in their bias or whatever, but you know, the extreme low carb zealots, the extreme vegan zealots, the extreme paleos, but also the grain of salt thing. I mean, there are the sort of extreme salt reduction people and then the extreme, nope, we don't need to reduce our salt at all. And that just, God, that confuses people. It confuses doctors, clinicians, dietitians, and patients. And it's, oh wait, that is, it's a whole nother thing to deal with all this stuff.
Yeah. My plug there would always be like, cause I was that like confused person when I was, you know, 19 or 20 or whatever. And I quickly realized that when you just are reading the results and discussion section, most people are skipping the methods. And the methods is what makes you an expert in things. And so I watched for years frustrated seeing people being like, oh, like low sodium intake is, you know, like even in between the 1500 milligram and 2300 milligram range is harmful now because of these, you know, big studies like Pure and whatnot that were coming out. And they're using like a single spot urine sodium to assess usual sodium intake. And the sodium in a single pee, like a single void, is not a reliable indicator of sodium intake at all. It's also like equations that are used to back transform that value measured in urine to like intake rely on a bunch of other factors like I think creatinine and whatnot are involved that can also be messed up in chronic, like can be a confounder in and of themselves. And but you saw like every internet diet expert being like low sodium is bad now and all, and it took until pretty much the I think in 2021 the National Academies of Sciences finally got enough money to relook at the DRIs of sodium, because they take like millions of dollars to do each systematic review and to get the guideline panel together, and they sort of just throw out that entire body of literature pointing out that like a single spot urine, actually its correlation with like multiple 24 hour urines is anywhere from like 0.1 to 0.9, because it's just like wildly variable and not a reliable indicator of intake. But you know, you have self-made internet careers off of like the truth about sodium and all this kind of stuff. And like people acting in good faith really need to become experts in methods. And that's hard to do outside of an academic environment in the lab that's like pioneering these sorts of things, but you can at least read those people's work and their critiques of it and figure out whether it's legitimate. And I kind of went a little crazy on this in my PhD training, because I wanted to do clinical trials. I wanted to know mass spec. I wanted to know analytical chemistry techniques and protein biology, because I was just like, how am I supposed to interpret this stuff if I don't really understand the nuances of the methods that people are using? And I've cooled down a little bit to accept that I can't know it all.
We lost Kevin.
we lost them.
Something happened with the internet in this silly podcasting internet world. Anyway, I was actually at Casey. Remember when we went to talking about the media and how they get things wrong? Remember when we were at the obesity conference? Mm-hmm. We went to the obesity conference, whatever it was, 4 years ago. Kevin Hall was debating David Ludwig on low carb versus high carb. But the big thing about it was, hey, this is a journalist meeting too. Like, we want this whole thing. We got to make sure that the journalists are getting this right. Right. And I think even Gardner was there from Stanford, how he was doing the Diet Fits trial. Anyway, it was a big deal about how, like, here are the results of the study. And they gave like fully in detail and basically said, now don't screw this up, journalists, because we know you guys do. And then they did. Right. They actually went on to screw it up, and they made it all like, and it was so funny. We were sitting there like, well, let's hopefully they get this right. And they didn't. So,
right. Except that the question is, did they not get it right on purpose, because they need some, they need the media attention.
Yeah,
they need some,
I know. It doesn't,
you know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. But that causes a trust issue. People already have a trust issue in this country with media, even though I think most of the extremes are unnecessary, but this stuff doesn't help. That's for sure.
Yeah. So, I mean, basically for the listener, it's really hard. I mean, cause like Kevin was saying, walnuts increase whatever you got to do these crossover trial designs, and then you have to have the right comparator group. It's really hard to do these studies. So you can imagine, people out there trying to just, make sure that they're eating right. I'd say the general principles of eating still apply. Lots of fruits and vegetables, legumes, nuts, that type of thing. Lean protein, whatever.
And the thing is, with all those dietary patterns we talk about, I mean, we've tried our best as clinicians who have a special interest in this to consider the totality of all the evidence, all the confounding epidemiology, observational data, and the trial evidence the best we can, along with research experts and other clinical experts who have tried to put this together to give basic recommendations. And so there are some things we know for sure, kind of like the dietary energy balance situation. We know that if there's a way to create an energy deficit, that will help with weight loss. And we have a pretty good idea for some of the dietary pattern type things and individual food issues for improving specific, health issues like, for the low carb zealots out there, cutting down on sugar, starch, processed carb intake does help with glycemia. If you have, type one or on the spectrum of type 2 diabetes, there are some dietary fat and fiber things, especially that can help with our cholesterol and our lipids. There are, certainly we know a little bit about that whole sodium thing we were kind of joking about, but, sodium and blood pressure mortality, it turns out maybe it has to do more with the potassium intake. Have you seen some of that discussion recently?
Yeah.
That's kind of the shift. It's really more of the potassium.
Yeah. Perhaps, and you still don't want to overload, but then going too low can actually increase risks of worsening.
So, thinking big picture for people, but then individualizing it and, so for those who are clinicians out there, you still got to take someone's individual dietary habits, think about it in the context of all the, literature that we do have, and no pun intended, taking it all with a grain of salt and personalizing it and monitoring their clinical outcomes too. So we have, obviously we have weight and blood pressure, and we have surrogate markers like lipids and glucose and stuff like that to improve upon that have really good evidence. So, individualized therapy, as always, this always ends up being that, right?
Yeah. So basically, don't just any headline that comes out. It just, honestly,
just use caution.
Just use extreme caution. So. The artificial sweeteners is the one that we see all the time.
Oh, that's
every
our big
week,
thing. Because
we'll get messaged
every time.
We'll get tagged all day. Hey, this new thing says microbiomes, or their cardiovascular disease. It's like, oh my God, it's the same. They just repeat the same headlines over and over again.
Yeah.
And we've gone over.
And it doesn't mean there's something to some of that.
There's
always something going on. But we got to think bigger picture. We have some really good data. You got to think about it in the context of this confusing stuff and the confounders and the biases that we just talked about. And then of course, half the time, a lot of the headlines we see, it turns out that it's in rodents, and that may or may not be helpful, but a lot of it's hypothesis generating for things to be studied later, but not something that should change your life necessarily.
Yeah. All right. Well, sorry we lost Kevin.
But we'll do a part two.
Yeah, we're going to do part two. We're going to talk about nutrition in pregnancy and everything like that. So, all right. Thanks, everyone. Make sure you give us a nice, solid review on whatever you're listening, whether it's Apple or Spotify or Google or I don't know, whatever you're listening to. Yeah,
just don't mention the fact that we lost our guest.
Yeah, and that we're... I don't even want to talk about the software that I'm using. I'm actually looking to a different software. I think it has something to do with the internet. But all right, here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities. We'll be right back.